This is an interview for the McKeldin Jackson Project of the Maryland Historical Society with Mrs. Peggy Waxter on January 26, 1976, at Mrs. Waxter's home on East Lane in Baltimore, Maryland. The interviewer is Ellen Paul. What I'd like to start out with is just some of the incidents you can tell me about that you personally were involved in. For example, you said your husband wouldn't cross the picket lines. Did you yourself involve yourself with any protests, say at the Druid Hill tennis courts or picket lines around theaters? Mm-hmm. Were you involved in any types of incidents?
And I always said that it was a good idea to wear white gloves when you picketed, because not too many people, I mean, you know, young people or people that looked overly poor, were very often the ones that were protesting, right? You know, and it was a good idea to have the world think that if this was a cross section of people, this wasn't anybody who needed anything or wanted everything especially for themselves. They wanted it for their children, not for their world, but they didn't want to. And I thought always made love. It was the only time I used to ever wear white gloves. It was when I was picketing. And that was always very helpful.
They told us the same thing during the war protest, to look neat and clean, and people would think more of what
they
were saying.
That's right.
It's very true.
And my grandson once, when he was collecting for the Sun paper, dressed up in a pale coat and things, and I was collecting money, and he said, "You come from the establishment." I laughed at him, and he said, "It works. They pay." I was once during a blackout. My husband had to have a card, you know, to go, and he didn't see very well at night anyway. And I was at a blackout at a YWCA child study meeting once when they had the first blackout. And it was fascinating because suddenly everybody was the same. And we were all sitting there in the darkness. And I think it was a Mr. Lewis who was head of the Urban League, was leaving Baltimore and going to a big job in New York at the Urban League. And it was very controlled, and they were talking, there were two or three white people, but not many mothers, and we were talking about children and problems of bringing up children in a racist society, and you know, how difficult it was. And it was all very neat and sort of, you know, they had a plan, like the white of the Urban League. And all of a sudden the blackout came. And it wasn't cool at all. You could hear it with sound. Get your head in there. Don't, you know, do this. Let's pull that curtain down. And we sat there in utter darkness all together. And Mr. Lewis was so honest. And he started talking about soldiers and people that couldn't go and buy a pair of socks in department stores. And I was very worried about my husband getting his hand because he couldn't see well enough, but I began to think, you know, this would solve the problem if we had a permanent blackout. Nobody need worry, you know, if we'd all be the same color, people would get along with the best they could with what they had, and it wouldn't be so difficult. So after that, I worked very hard on this committee. And I can't exactly remember the name of it. We had stickers, and our enemy was Mr. Hutzler. We went to Mr. Hutzler and said, you know, this is ridiculous. And I told about this experience with you. And these people want to be able to shop. And they don't want to have to go to New York to lawmakers or something. And they want to spend money in Baltimore. And we formed this little committee with this wonderful woman who had been missing in Ireland, Mrs. Wagner. She had been, she was a Presbyterian, and I think it was just over, but she lived in China. And she used to tell us how her people traveled in China, that they were, we smelled it, it was like, then radiated, and they'd come, the Chinese people would come and break all the windows if the American was sitting in those near them. So she was very, very knowledgeable and older, and knew a great deal about prejudice. And she was a great leader. She lived that town near where the King Center was. For a while, she, I think, had moved away in Michigan. But Mrs. Carver, she was in Colorado. But anyway, she started this committee about the department stores, and we kept saying to Mr. Hubsley and everybody, you know, you've got to start somewhere. If you could just make let people go. And then one woman remembers a told her story about not being able to buy a pair of socks to send to Europe to her with her son who was fighting for the democracy in this country. And she couldn't go into a store and get a pair of socks. So we had a very active little committee that went around and tried. I had someone that worked with me once, and we went down to Lane Bias, and we sat outside the store listening to what was going on, and they kept saying we can do it, and we had a civil, and so the black people were not doing it all. And Mr. Hutler kept saying, it's people like the Waxers and the Hollanders that, you know, are just different. Other people don't feel like you do, and then the community wants to have people shop. And they were worried most about hats on the road, because they used to be something else. And when the community wants this, we're ready to do it. And he told me what a leader does. He said, a leader never gets out too far, so the people that are following him can't see where they're going. And you and Mr. Waxer, people like the Hollanders and all, are too far out there. This may come someday, but not now. People are not ready for this.
So he kept saying
we were ready, and we had these little stickers. And the idea was that we'd pay our bill, and I would try to find one of those stickers. It was blue with white lettering. And you would have put that out. Democracy, because we loaded people shop, wasn't that, but it was a little kind of slogan. And we put those on. They had a report feelings about race relations. Mayor and the governor, they wouldn't let them see it. It was in a desk right beside, there was a big Catholic man, the governor is no tree, but I could find out. Big Catholic family, and he did this report. And nobody saw it.
Mr.
Hutzler might get upset.
Mr. Hutzler wasn't so worried about his own personal feelings, but what everybody else in Baltimore area would say if you let black people shop in the store.
Mr. Hustler.
No, he was not personally concerned.
He was a very bright man, a very kind, good man, and a fine citizen. That's what he told us. We never quite believed him because I kept saying to him, you're a leader. If Hustler does it, everybody else is going to do it. It's going to be the thing to do. That was my idea of what a leader was, that they did something before somebody else.
Did you finally persuade him to change his mind?
No. They had trouble and they broke some windows, I remember once, and all kinds of violent things. He didn't, this was, you know, it was just like dropping water on somebody's head. It was just, you know, over and over. But it had to come from many more groups than our little group. But it has always taught me that somewhere people have to begin. Somebody has to be out front and see. Shot at or to be called names or, you know, this is just the way the thing works. And as long as people hold back and say it's not going to be me, the longer these things take, that seems to be the pattern.
Was there any one event that got you personally interested in social work and in black civil rights and in all the different organizations you worked for?
Any one moment, you mean?
Moment or an event, or is it just a general feeling that you've always had?
Well, I had a remarkable mother. A lot of people think I got a lot of things from the director, certainly I did. But my mother used to tell me, and she believed, you know, that everybody was equal and everybody was nice or they weren't nice and it didn't really much matter. She was remarkable in that way for her day because that was my years ago, and she came from Kentucky. And she really treated people as people. and not as one kind of people or another kind of people. So I do think that, and sometimes it works just the opposite way. If a young person comes out of a bed ready to come, then they don't want to do anything but that. Fabulous room, and they be away over the other way.
When you moved to this area, to Roland Park, certain groups of people were not allowed to live here.
No,
or it was very difficult. How
still
did
kids.
Yeah, very true.
Restricted.
Did you feel that you had to campaign against that and to try and let other people in here? Or did was
well,
that
I've always had people here, you know, black people and any people that I enjoyed or worked with. And I've been criticized, I guess, for that. And when Mr. Wexler died, I know my real estate man came here to hear that I was going to sell the house. He came to see me. I thought he was coming to put condolences. Instead, I wanted to see why I was going to do it. That never has bothered me. I mean, I've always been of the opinion if I had thought often it might be a good idea, especially after Mr. Wexler died, if I would go and live in a black neighborhood. But then I have gotten the opinion that if all the people that feel that way moved away, then we would have worse kind of feelings than we have. It is much better for me to stay where I am and keep, you know, I don't have to say anything about it. I did have a friend once that said she invited me to dinner and stuff, so. And as we got to the car, she opened the door and I got in. And she said, I had the most terrible dream about you last night. I dreamt that you were coming to dinner, and there were hordes of black people behind you, coming with you. And I didn't know what to do. She was a very nice social leader in the big house. And I've always been taught, she said, to treat people well in my house. So I didn't know how to deal with all these people. That you were coming, and I kept thinking it was very funny because maybe a lot of people look at me and see all the black people behind them. In those days, they may have looked at me.
Let me ask you some questions about Governor McKeldin, too, because
mm-hmm.
that's who the project is concerned with.
Exactly.
What kind of relationship did you have with McKeldin on a personal level? Were you and the judge friendly with
oh,
him?
Oh, very. We went to Liberia, to Africa. We would, in 19, I guess it was whenever he went to Liberia, 56, wasn't it? We celebrated the 100th anniversary of the founding of Liberia.
So that
and
on a personal level, you really were quite friendly with the man?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and Mrs. Dick, she was wonderful to travel. When I danced with that black man over there in Liberia, he said that, I said, what do you think my children will think of my grandchildren when they go up in the attic and find all these things from Liberia? And we had been talking at dinner. He said, what they would do, he said, they would rise up and call you blessed. This black man said. But McKeldin was good that night. When I, after it was over, she doesn't dance, Mrs. McKeldin. And she, was asked to dance for the president of Liberia, President Zahn, and he finally said, well, you have to. So she got up and danced just me. Well, I liked that. So I danced hard. They had a black band, you know, an African band, and then an American one. And when we got through, I noticed they gave my, Tugman gave my money to the Star of Africa or something. And when I got through, he came up to me and he said, you did your country more good for me. And all the ambassadors and everybody else. Just having a good time.
Sure.
Yeah.
And because it was honest and came straight from the heart.
That's right.
And
that's
I did.
That's right.
You told me a story about this picture of your husband
mm-hmm.
and how he used to show people around the city of Baltimore mm-hmm. in the slums, and you said this was in the 40s, this
yeah,
picture
40s or 40s.
Of the poor housing conditions
yeah.
and the outhouses. And you told me an amusing story about Governor McKeldin and when your husband took him down there. Would you like to repeat that for me?
Well,
because I think it's worth saving.
He had a way of feeling, he always used to say to me, if people really knew, if they would face up to what the problems of poverty and the people were, if they knew what was happening, they would wouldn't feel as kindly or want to help people as much as anybody. It's the people that don't know. So he used to take his more conservative friends, business friends, and people out to lunch. And they would always go on tours. I mean, say they asked for their housing or help or something. And one day he had a film who had appointed him in the welfare department. And he took him on one of these tours. And the film always told this story. And they went and stood in front of this old house, down South Baltimore. And he said, look at that, isn't it terrible? People, citizens, real people live. And McKeldin started to look very upset and smiled and I guess cried a little bit and he said, that's my old homestead. That's the house I was born in. So that was, he often told that story.
How did Judge Baxter come to be appointed by McKeldin? Were they friendly before? Did they know each other?
Of course, McKeldin being a Republican, but we used to always think he was a Democratic Republican because he was so liberal, and certainly on the subject of race. He was in there under Jackson first, you see, and then he had to be reappointed rather than just picking him out of the blue, so he kept him on. But he always spoke about how that was one of the things McKeldin was very much about was people and how to get the right people in the right spot to help him. And he was more bad than he asked him to do.
Well, Judge Waxer certainly has an impressive record of his own involvement with social welfare and civil rights.
Okay.
Can you tell me a little bit about how he himself became involved in that, your husband? What stimulated his interest and what kind of events he worked with besides his official job?
He used to always say that his grandfather, who was General Fry, I think he was a Republican too, Thomas Jacob Fry, he was named. When he was a little boy, they took a walk, and he remembers General Fry, who was a businessman, and he was a big mason, and when he died, I think they had a rabbi, and a Catholic priest, and a Protestant, all saying prayers at his funeral. So maybe General Fry started the whole thing, I don't know. But he put his hand on his head and he said, Tom, the most important thing in the world is people.
And I would take it that you and your husband were not just concerned with black civil rights or any kind of specific social welfare, but just with the general welfare of all people.
That's
and you
right.
were too concerned right. with which
but
movement.
But you had to fight, you know, and you still do for the people that are underneath.
Did you work?
And he used to tell me, they could say, you know, I cannot treat children like we have treated black children, send them to school, and tell them that they're going to be president of the United States someday, and then suddenly when they get to be about a teenager, they find that's all lies. And a great deal of resentment, and they join gangs, and they start taking dope, and they get mad, and they start to kill and rape. And this is, we've set it up.
Let's stop this. During the years that your husband was involved in both the city and the state welfare agency, was it harder at that time for black people to come and get welfare and to get help? Did they find resistance from the local officials and from the lower level government, from the bureaucrats?
Not when he was the head of the department, I can assure you. Not ever. I mean, there may have been some incidents that probably were of people prejudiced, welfare workers or something. But this, I think, so often trickles down from the top. Depends on who's at the top. Just how that works. Of course, he was criticized much more by other people, you know, called a communist, and people would get up because he always told the story about these little boys and how they couldn't be treat people like that. And what was going to happen if we couldn't, you know, see that people had good health and see that they had food and good housing and all of the things that would bring up a normal group of people. And He used to always say, when the revolution comes, you and I will be the first ones to go. I've always remembered that. Because we knew what was happening all the time, and we couldn't persuade other people. And so the most resentment will be for the people that have helped the most, not to the world.
So he was certainly a good deal ahead of his time.
Oh.
It's too bad we don't have someone like that running welfare agencies.
Right now.
It really is.
That's right.
Hey, let me ask you, there has been some criticism of Governor McKeldin because some people feel that he was only active in civil rights to the extent that it would help his political career. And he wouldn't step too far forward, and yet at the same time he wouldn't lag behind.
This is McKeldin?
McKeldin, right, Governor McKeldin.
Absolutely. Yeah. He was a very political animal by nature, but underneath that was that deep care. And I can prove that by an incident about him. You want an incident? We were in Portugal on the way home from Africa from this trip where we had seen great poverty, and my husband in Africa wanted to set up a welfare department right away, quick, and they weren't quite ready for that. But McKeldin took us on a trip to a big cathedral there where they had a lot of healing. Oh, I'm not too bad about names. But anyway, we went in this car, and it was through a very desolate part of it. It was a cold, windy day, and we stopped to see a windmill that was doing something very primitive, and the driver wanted us to see this. And down the road, in a little house, the only house nearby, some children came out with flowers that they had left ready for tourists or something, and they came out holding these flowers to give us as we were looking at the windmill came up the hill. And he started fighting, and my husband sort of nudged me because when we traveled with him, we'd seen him do this. He got out his picture, he got out the button of the state of Maryland, the Black Eyed Susan, and he kept saying, "Now I'm the governor of Maryland. And I want you to have my picture, and I want to talk to you." He talked to him just as if they were going to come back the next day and vote for him. And Jake said to me afterwards, "You see, it's just perfectly natural with him. He wasn't doing this for any real reason. It was his really feeling about it. And he just went through this act right up there on that lonely hill to those children from Portugal, just the same as if he'd been in any one of the districts of Maryland, hard to get votes." So this, I think, people have misinterpreted, this enthusiasm of his and this caring, as being sort of automatic. And in a sense, I think that politicians do get that way. But his was never really automatic, because when the chips were down, he never failed.
Did McKeldin initiate any civil rights movements? Was he pushing, as far as you know, for legislature?
Always. I can't say specifically.
No.
But he, in the same way that my husband did, you know, turn over backwards to do more for the people that have this. Just as simple as that.
So it was a constant concern with him. It was not
That's
something
right.
he did at election time.
Never, so. Never, never. Never. Absolutely good.
Your husband wrote a long, long letter concerning the welfare in the city of Baltimore, and he talked about race relations, and he talked about also certain other political things like capitalism that some people didn't like and felt that he shouldn't have talked about. How did McKeldin respond to that letter?
I think, was it D'Alessandro at that time, or was it
McKeldin was the governor, and D'Alessandro was the governor. But I understand that a copy was sent to the governor's office. And to
oh, that was, big to-do, and who paid for it, and all of that. And that was a big, and why should he have to connect up all of that? Well, he had to connect up all of that because that was the history. And I mean, you can't, just as we were saying before, you can't take one little piece of this without taking the whole thing. And the race did have a lot to do with the way people were feeling. You asked me if I could remember one thing. I can remember that when I really found out. The Junior League, I was president of the Junior League once, and this was after my term, and they had a BERC, Baltimore Emergency Relief Committee. And people were, it was when apples were being sold on the street corners, people were hungry and people were in the middle of the Depression. And all of these people used to bring their old clothes down. And these nice Junior League girls, and they were nice, they were, you know, wanted to do something. Privileged people, and we would have a pile that went to the black people, and all the holy ones would go there. And I used to cheat and send as many
the good ones
the other way. And that said something to me. I think that that was important for me, just as a person, to see that. You know, with people that didn't know they were doing anything. It's just, you know, these people were chipless, given a hose, and soon anyway, to be given, what's that?
Did you have a hard time persuading your own friends of your ideas? Did you ever get into fights with them?
Oh yes. But they used to, I guess, treat me the way that many people are treating people now, by saying that you're a racist if you go too far one way or the other. We didn't say that then, but I think that's what they probably thought, that I was so extreme that I was doing much more harm than good. And I was really, that was just, I was stupid, or I didn't understand how these things work. But in a way, they have, I think, liked me in spite of it, although I have another friend that told me once that people say dreadful things about me, and she would see me go up to these people, and they'd be so nice to me and talk to me, and I said, I don't wonder who they are. I like people, and I'm not, you know, I don't care what they say about me.
And now, so, of course, they realize that you were right the whole time.
I'm not sure.
You still have to convince them.
No, I think people are very frightened. Like, I think fear is at the bottom of all of it. But nobody, Mr. Huxley didn't know what would happen to the store if people came. And it was once they came in gradually into the lyric, into, you know, they're afraid. They're afraid in schools now.
When McKeldin was governor, and when he was mayor, when he was involved in the Republican Party politics, there were a good many people within his own party that didn't agree with him, the old line Republicans, as well as, of course, all the other people that simply just didn't like his ideas. Yeah. How did he defend himself? How did he defend his ideas? What did he say to people to convince them, or at least to explain to them how he felt and why he felt that way?
He laughed a lot. And he was tolerant of their intolerance, I think. My husband is too. And I think that's very important, because everybody develops along different lines. And if you are wrong or right and way out one way, you know, you have to listen to those other people. And I think he was very, smart about people. And he knew when someone was, you know, really maybe working over things. That, I remember another incident of a neighbor of mine in Roland Park at the meat counter one day. She was a very leader of society, a very conservative person. And she came up to me at the meat counter, and I was embarrassed because I had on slacks. In those days we didn't go to meat counters. And I found her coming up to me, and she said, you know, I feel better about myself now. I'm coming along nicely. And I didn't know what she meant. And I said, what do you mean? She said, what do you mean? She said, I heard your husband at the YW talk about My Doll's book, you know, the American Dilemma. And he reviewed that book, and I was frightened to death, and I thought there was dreadful things he was saying, perfectly dreadful. And I went back, and I've been studying very intelligent. I'm reading and thinking about this subject. And I've come a long way, she said. And I thought that was a very honest statement. She was never going to be a great rapper or anything. But she was, you know, willing to be honest with herself, to really look into something that she hadn't maybe paid attention to.
And Governor McKeldin and your husband believed in working with people like that instead of against them.
That's right.
I think there were probably a lot of people like that to work with.
That's right. That's right. And not just discover. And I think that young people are more impatient usually than older people, and you're always impatient than young. And you would just get furious. And I noticed as my husband grew older, he used to argue less. He wasn't as much fun in that way, because he wouldn't try to persuade them. He'd just say that way, and I'd say, if you're that way, and I was your friend, and you knew how you felt, and I didn't, you know, even talk to them about it, I'd feel much worse.